Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, November 27th. Hope you had a good Thanksgiving. Well, the week started with a revelation from a Stanford University professor and nuclear expert, Siegfried S. Hecker, who was shown a new uranium enrichment facility that is part of the North's Yongbyon nuclear complex. Hecker wrote that he was blown away by the advanced nature of it, calling it stunning, and said it would pass for a new nuclear energy plant in the United States, complete with the latest in centrifuge technology. While his handlers assured him the uranium enrichment taking place was for peaceful purposes only, and North Korea is in dire need of electricity, the facility can quickly be converted to the processing of weapons-grade material. The Obama administration immediately scrambled to say the United States has been aware North Korea was looking to build a uranium enrichment plant of this kind for 10 years, and that just a few weeks ago, President Obama had confronted Chinese President Hu Jintao on the topic. But clearly, U.S. intelligence was totally blindsided as the exact site, which is right under their noses, seeing as we have Yongbyon under constant satellite surveillance. So, among the many immediate issues is how does North Korea get the latest in centrifuge technology with all the sanctions that have been arrayed against it, and are there other such facilities hidden away? Plus, more importantly, is North Korea cooperating with the likes of Iran for the purposes of passing on weapons-grade material? We already know these two have been sharing all manner of missile technology. Does this mean that Iran's own problems on the enrichment front aren't as important because Iran can just get their enriched uranium from Pyongyang? South Korea said it shared grave concerns with the U.S. over the revelation, while Japan called the development absolutely unacceptable. Seoul said it would have to consider basing U.S. nuclear weapons back on its soil, where they haven't been since 1991. So this was a big story on the week for the Korean Peninsula, until Tuesday, that is. Prior to the G20 summit in Seoul, I made the statement that there would be a deadly incident there, precipitated by North Korea as a coming-out party for Kim Jong-il's son and heir apparent, Kim Jong-un. This didn't occur. But it turns out it wasn't so wrong after all, because on Tuesday, in the heaviest attack on South Korean soil since the Korean War ended in 1953, North Korea shelled a civilian island, killing two South Korean soldiers and two civilians, as well as exacting heavy property damage on a population of 1,300. The South returned fire while Washington sent an aircraft carrier and vowed to hold new joint exercises with its allies. Of course, it was just last March that 46 South Korean soldiers were killed when their patrol boat was torpedoed by the North or sunk by a mine, and South Korean President Lee is under increasing pressure in some quarters to fight back. But Lee and everyone else in the South Korean government knows that a full-blown conflict between North and South would destroy the Korean economic miracle, let alone kill hundreds of thousands. Through it all, China, North Korea's lone ally and sole benefactor, when the West isn't being blackmailed, as Pyongyang is attempting to do again, has refused to condemn Kim Jong-il's regime for its action. A spokesman for the Chinese Foreign Ministry said, quote, China strongly urges both North and South Korea exercise calm and restraint and as quickly as possible engage in dialogue and contacts. China has long been fearful that North Korea would implode, sending millions of refugees across its border. Editorial, Wall Street Journal. Given Kim Jong-il's ill health, it is tempting to conclude that a dictator wants to go out in a blaze of suicidal glory, but the North's behavior is entirely rational given the way it has been rewarded for past misbehavior. Mr. Lee has tried to break that pattern by taking a tougher line. Now the North is testing his and America's resolve. The Obama administration deserves credit for tightening the financial screws and developing this important source of leverage. South Korea can add to this financial pressure by finally shutting down the Kaesong Industrial Complex, a major source of hard currency for the North. The U.S. ought to leave no doubt that it will defend South Korea. China needs to know the U.S. can't tolerate a proliferating North Korea and that it is prepared to act militarily if other deterrents fail. The Kims believe they can get away with their acts of war because they have never paid a serious price for them. They will continue their assaults until they do. Robert Kaplan, Financial Times. North Korea's aggression threatens not only South Korea, but Japan too. Its leadership is as much national fascist as communist and has manifested deep hostility to the Japanese, which occupied the Korean Peninsula from 1910 to 1945. In short, Japan is getting real-life experience of what maritime Asia would be like without unipolar American power. Robert Kaplan continues, here the U.S. administration should expect no respite from Pyongyang. The great Asian proclivity for thinking in terms of the long arc of history is absent in North Korea, the only country in East Asia whose leaders have no strategic vision for the long term. They are obsessed with short-term survival, most clearly expressed by their nuclear program. Precisely because economic liberalization could destabilize the fragile police state, the Kim family knows there is no way to guarantee survival except through a nuclear deterrent. America's fear of North Korea's ability to proliferate, let alone detonate a primitive weapon in the face of an invasion, is what brings Washington to the bargaining table. The North Koreans know that if Saddam Hussein had nuclear capability in 2003, he and his sons would be in power today. Consequently, they have invested much in their program. They risk relations with neighbors South Korea and China precisely because of the program's centrality to regime survival. It was Robert Kaplan in the Financial Times. Let's move on to the European debt crisis. These are incredibly depressing times in much of Europe, and the anger is spreading. Whether it was a general strike in Portugal, unheard of here, student protests throughout Italy, more student protests in the UK, planned massive demonstrations in Ireland today, and Spain, there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty and inconsistent political leadership. When it comes to the European Union, Germany's Angela Merkel and France's Nicolas Sarkozy want you to believe they are leading and talk about the European bailout mechanism already in place being sufficient to deal with the likes of Greece and Ireland, let alone Portugal and maybe Spain or Belgium or Italy or France, but then they issue conflicting comments on where the banks will have to take a haircut on their sovereign debt holdings, which German Central Bank Chief Axel Weber says will have to be the case, even as he offers that the bailout fund needs more capital when many Europeans are loath to pony up more aid. Is it any wonder, then, why borrowing costs for nations like Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain are going through the roof at the worst possible time as the governments attempt to right their ships? The cross currents in the euro debt crisis are hard to keep track of. They are so numerous, and it will be a wonder to see the 16-nation euro currency stick together. I don't see how it possibly can. One or two exiting the euro, such as Greece and or Ireland, would not be the end of the world, but I've always said it's about the people in each country and the pressure politicians will be under when their countrymen don't want to keep bailing out their neighbors, some of whom are historical enemies. But there is just so much debt sloshing around, much of it still really unknown because of the lack of real transparency in nations such as Greece, and these systemic risks are real and closer to being realized than many of us may understand. For this past week and next, though, the issue of immediacy remains Ireland, which is hoping to wrap up its bailout package this weekend, even as the tottering government pleads for its austerity program to be passed by Parliament when it comes up for a vote on December 7. The austerity plan is brutal, with the middle class in Ireland getting hit particularly hard, mainly because they're the ones who can withstand the pain. Many in the upper class are insolvent. Social welfare programs are being slashed to the bone. New taxes of all kinds will be imposed. Further public sector job cuts, a 12% cut in the minimum wage, further pension cuts, and all the while the real estate crisis continues unabated. I've written this before, but it's still staggering to think that Ireland's home construction rate at the height of the bubble was 6 times that of the UK. But while the Irish government, as fractured as it is today, knows it must pass the plan, the credibility of it is called into question because future projected growth rates simply aren't dealing with reality. Growth? How the hell are you going to have growth in an economy like this? But this is where Ireland has been adamant about keeping its corporate tax rate at 12.5% because the likes of Microsoft, Pfizer, and Google employ 240,000 on the Emerald Isle, and all the multinationals have made it clear. Any sizable hike in the tax rate and they're out of there. Ireland must export its way out of the depression. Gerald Holtom, Financial Times. Ireland is like Iceland. Their banks participated in unwise real estate speculation. Their system is now insolvent. The Irish state knew it had to bail out its banks, but their balance sheets were large in relation to GDP, exactly the Icelandic dilemma. The Irish know that if their banks fail, their liabilities will fall on other European banks, especially in Germany and Britain. Some of those are fragile themselves. A chain reaction and panic in money and bond markets could easily ensue. In other words, another Lehman Brothers. Whereas PIMCO's Mohammed El Arian wrote, quote, "The dramatic events in Ireland are just preambles for the many further chapters yet to be fully devised, let alone written, if crisis is to be averted. Let us hope that these chapters do not end up having to also cover Portugal and Spain." Portugal is to release its own austerity plan on January 1, but many question whether they'll make it without a bailout before then. But the big enchilada is Spain, the Eurozone's fourth largest economy. On Friday, Prime Minister Zapatero was issuing the usual denials that Spain doesn't need a bailout, but to me it's a certainty. Their housing bubble is of spectacularly mammoth proportions, and with the massive amounts of inventory across the country, home prices could tumble another 20% by some estimates. I'd say that's a lock, and Spain has 20% unemployment. How the heck is it going to grow more than a percent or two when it needs growth of 5, 6, and 7% to pay off its debts and be able to raise future capital at reasonable rates? Meanwhile, in China, there are fears the inflation situation is beyond the control of the government, but I'm here to tell you that is not going to be the case. Some food prices are indeed coming down, and I believe unrest can be kept to a minimum. Chinese authorities have also introduced an interesting stamp duty on housing, wherein there is a 15% tax if a property is resold within 6 months of purchase, down to 5% for 12 to 24 months. No doubt China's economy will slow some, but little more than that, assuming tensions ease on the Korean Peninsula, and that's an admittedly big if. As for the U.S., the economic news was mixed, as were the equity markets. New and existing home sales for October were awful, with the median price dipping anew, though still above the spring 2009 lows, and the durable goods figure for October is well below estimates. But on the plus side, third quarter GDP was revised up to 2.5%, though still far short of the growth we need to put a dent in the unemployment rate. While the October personal income and consumption figures were pretty good, and the holiday shopping season appears to have gotten off to a good start, I'm not negative in this regard like I have been the past few years. The thing is that you still have the situation with state and local governments continuing to cut to the bone, which means further job losses, and as Meredith Whitney projected, U.S. banks will be closing 5,000 branches the next 18 months and possibly 10,000 by 2015. For one reason, because there are fewer and fewer bankable customers. And when the new Congress gets to work in January, they better come up with a credible fiscal package, or the United States will find itself in a Euro-like situation, possibly as soon as 2012. Economist Robert Samuelson, Washington Post, quote, "The problem is not reducing the deficit, it's controlling spending in a way that seems socially just, economically sensible, and politically tolerable. If we are honest, neither party has been, it means asking how much we allow benefits for the old to burden the young, through higher taxes, lower public services, slower economic growth, and weakened national security. Any genuine debate must be wrenching because government has promised more than it can realistically deliver, and lower benefits or higher taxes will leave many feeling, justifiably, mistreated. No one would be happy. Liberals would have to accept sizable benefit cuts, conservatives, tax increases. Recognizing this logic, America's leaders have averted their eyes and held their tongues. President Obama continues this inglorious avoidance. His Obamacare actually made matters worse by increasing the least controllable spending. The initial reception to Bowles-Simpson has been predictably tepid. But even if it passed Congress, it would only be a first step." That was Robert Samuelson. So, happy holidays, guys. Stocks finished mixed, with the Dow Jones down 1% to 1192, while the S&P 500 dipped 0.9% and NASDAQ rose 0.6%. Considering the dual crises of Korea and Europe, not bad, not bad at all. That's all I have for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday. Have a great one, and for further details, especially on the Euro crisis, you can click on Week in Review at stocksandnews.com. Take care.